Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Murad on tour.com.
Today on Midnight in Karachi, I'm joined by Kate Elliott, who is the writer of a number of fantasy and science fiction series, including the Crossroad trilogy, the Spirit Walker series, Crown of Stars, and many novels previously written as Alice Rasmussen. Her newest book is the YA fantasy Court of Fives, and her next novel for adults is Black Wolves, out later this year. Welcome to Midnight in Karachi, Kate.
Thank you.
Now, you and I first...
And because of our time, I just wanted to mention, because of our time zones, we are actually recording this at almost midnight in
almost.
Karachi.
I think by the time we get done, it will be midnight in Karachi. It will indeed. You and I first met about a year ago. Actually, I think it was right around this time in August, maybe a week or so from now, last year at Worldcon in London. And we were both on a panel about diversity, along with some other really great people. It was a good discussion, wasn't it?
It was.
And I think even in this last year, there seems to have been this surge forward in a positive direction, Hugo's situation notwithstanding. What do you think?
I think what's interesting is how the discussion is now changing. I'm seeing more people expressing that they're a little tired of hearing the word diversity, not because... they don't want to hear diversity anymore, that they don't want to talk about diversity anymore, but they're beginning to see that this word diversity is actually can be seen as a smokescreen, and that really diversity should be so embedded in what we're doing that we don't have to use the word anymore. And I know that's kind of a pipe dream, but but I think that is where we should be headed. So for instance, instead of people being put on diversity panels because they're not male, not white, they should be put on panels about the subjects that they're doing. So I find, like, for instance, for myself, if I go to a convention and I get put on a panel about gender or a panel about diversity, that's good. It's good that we're talking about those things. But if I don't get put on a panel about writing epic fantasy, then we're still not where we need to be. Does that make sense? And
absolutely.
I think more people are talking about that aspect of it.
Yeah. I think it's easy to pick up on those things and to point those things out, and I think they're absolutely correct. But at the same time, I feel like at least that conversation has come up, and that conversation has come up only because people are making a move towards this. I don't want the tokenism either, but then I think, is the tokenism better than nothing?
Oh, it's absolutely better than nothing. And maybe this is the only way it can move forward. And it's also important to have the discussions on multiple fronts. There isn't one way to do it right. And I think that there is a wider range of people writing and discussing now than there was when I started in the field 25 years ago. Even more than that, I'm seeing a much more international crowd. We saw that at London Worldcon to a degree that I have yet to see in the United States, which is a little more provincial. But just, you know, I was on panels with people from multiple countries, which is so rare in the U.S. to find. And I know that part of that is because it's hard to get into the U.S. For people coming in to visit. So I think this is just going to continue. And I think for me, I identify one of the main vectors of this discussion as being social media. The fact that you and I can talk on Skype,
right,
on this podcast right now, the fact that on Twitter I have, you know, I'm in communication on Twitter with people from literally all around the world. And as more of those voices connect, you know, we can find each other out there, and we don't see ourselves as these little isolated people. I think before, when, you know, before it was more like, for instance, when I was a kid, I was like the only one I knew who was reading science fiction and fantasy. So I thought it was something that, you know, there were only three of us doing in the world. And now I can see that it's not true. We're all over. And the people who have the same interests as me are all over. So this ability to connect with each other then helps us support each other and raise our voice and raise these discussions without feeling like we're going to get slapped down or that there's no one supporting us. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, it's opened up a whole world that I didn't know existed, for good or bad. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, for good or bad. Yeah, the bad goes with the good.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. The thing that I talk about a lot is about this whole system of gatekeeping. When there's only, you know, When my first novel came out, and there were only a few venues where you could get reviewed, because most of the book selling went on because people would go into bookstores and browse. On my first novel, I think got 5 reviews, and I think my second novel got 3 reviews that I was aware of. I mean, imagine that today. I can't even imagine that today. And there's so many more places where people can talk about books now because of blogging, because of social media, because of all these multiple platforms. So there's the possibility for more visibility than there was before, and which means that these very few people who gatekept what could get through and what couldn't, that's beginning to dissolve. And this is one reason that you get some of the people who are like, I haven't heard this argument so much in the last couple of years, but maybe, you know, a few years ago, it was like, well, these random book bloggers, you know, they're no good and they're ruining criticism. And I'm thinking like, you know, criticism, what they're ruining is people's ability to stand on top of the heap and control what people talk about. And I think that's fantastic that we're ruining that.
In the past, in your very prolific, extensive writing career, you've set stories in settings influenced by, I don't know, Central Asia, medieval Europe, Southeast Asia, West African cultures. And now with this new novel, the new YA novel, Court of Fives, it's got these Greco-Roman influences for the world building. What draws you to these influences each time? I mean, I want to say international influences, but I suppose, once again, diverse is the word that would be more commonly used.
I have taken a range. If you look at my very first published novel, The Labyrinth Gate, The Labyrinth Gate was influenced by T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland and by Robert Graves' The White Goddess, which is a book that Robert Graves, who's a poet and a writer, wrote about trying to reconstruct the language of poetry and trees in, I don't know, ancient Britain. It's not at all remotely academic, and I think it's more his like poetical exegesis, if I'm pronouncing that word right. But I liked it not because I believed everything he said, but because I just liked the way he was stringing things together. So if you look at that, you see a more kind of standard Western European British Isles influence, which is kind of probably my core influence actually is Scandinavian American, because my mother's Danish and my father's the grandchild of Danish American immigrants. What's interesting is I have yet to write anything set in a Scandinavian or Nordic flavored element except for one of the cultures in Court of Stars. Crown of Stars. I'm getting my book titles confused. And so I started from there, and then I just began to, as I read history, because I, although I majored in English in college, I also took a lot of history classes. My father's a historian, taught American history. And the more I read, every time I would take a step outward, it just, I don't know any other way to explain it except to say, it just fascinates me. People fascinate me. Cultures fascinate me. The sweep of history, then the way cultures interact and come together, and either in conflict or in cooperation, how they trade influences across these vast distances. It just fascinates me. And so once you start down that road, it never ends, because you can never find out all of it. And there's always another culture. Every culture I've ever read about is like fascinating to me, historically or modern. They're all so unique. They're like people. They're all so unique. I can't really go beyond that. So I keep finding something new that is new knowledge to me, and then it becomes fascinating all over again. The Greco-Roman Egypt influence comes about because my husband and another man got what's called the concession to work on a Greco-Roman site in the Delta region of Egypt, and about 6 years ago. And so because he was working there, I started reading about it, and then I got interested in it because the Ptolemaic era is fascinating for a number of reasons, but not least of which is this idea that these people came from outside and established themselves as the ruling class over this huge number of this indigenous population who had once ruled themselves perfectly well. Because, of course, they were one of the great, everyone acknowledged them as one of the great civilizations in the ancient world. And here came these Macedonians, established themselves And then the Romans, and then even the laws would then benefit the outsiders and the foreigners. And that whole dynamic, I mean, that's another fascinating dynamic, not least in part because the United States, of course, is an imperial nation founded right. on, well, let's be honest, founded on the genocide of the indigenous population, and of course on the labor of the slaves who were brought over in, you know, in these horrible ships from Africa, ship after ship, and treated in so inhumanly that it's shocking to even think about it, or it should be shocking to even think about it. And so you have these two parts, and then this idea of liberty, and then that's the United States for you. So I think that that aspect of Greco-Roman Egypt is, you know, reminds me a little bit, or it's can be a little bit related to the history of the U.S. So if you throw, that's how I do things. If you throw those things together, then they start growing something in my head.
So for each of these, and it's difficult to refer to all of your work, I guess, in one sort of any blanket question, but still, for each of these worlds that you have built, did sort of the story come first? Did the plot, the characters come first? Or did, as you were just saying, bunch of things mixed together in your head to create the setting first?
I think that what happens to me first is that, because I think kind of cinematically, I can trace, not all, but I can trace most of my novels to an image in my head, which is a character in a setting. So I think character and setting come first for me. And then it has to sit for a while in the back of my head so I can kind of get a plot to attach to it.
And how much of this glorious world building that you do, how much of it is research and how much of it is just making things up with complete abandon? Because that must be fun too.
Well, you know, I don't think we ever make things up without context. Because I actually wrote an essay about this called The Status Quo Does Not Need World Building, with this idea that, you know, why are people doing so much research about, you know, these worlds, and they should just make stuff up. But we don't just make stuff up. The stuff in our heads is where the stuff that we know, the stuff we've experienced, all of the things we make up come from some syncretic version, or from what we're pulling up from underneath. We don't just make things up. It can't come from nowhere. That would be my argument. So I would say that sometimes I deliberately focus on a research area and borrow or steal, if you will, or appropriate, some would say, and that's a fair criticism as well. You know, I'll research Greco-Roman Egypt, and then I'll borrow things from that. But I won't use it directly, because except for the Spirit Walker trilogy, everything has been set in secondary worlds, because I'm not interested in writing historical fantasy. And the only reason I did Spirit Walker that way was because I wanted to, there was something specific I wanted to do, which is why I set it in an alternate history Earth. So I think that the making up, the stuff that I make up is the stuff that I didn't want to be as it was in history. So what I usually do is I kind of tweak it around or torque it around or borrow something from, pull something in from somewhere else. Because everything that I make up is based on, as I said, what I know. And so the more I read, the more depths I have to pull from, if that makes sense.
Right.
And I find that in periods when I'm not reading much nonfiction, I feel like my creative sense, my ability to world build begins to flatten. It's like the more I read and put in there, the more it can churn around down there and things can attach from other places. And the richer it gets, the more I know about the richness of human experience across time and across cultures, the richer my world building can be.
And it leads me to a question that I had a little later, but I'm going to pull that up now. Because you're essentially, as you said, making up worlds, and as you've just said, based on all the things that you know while writing fantasy. I imagine some people must assume that you write in a sort of a vacuum almost, but of course I always doubt that even fantasy writers can ignore the world around them and, you know, not be influenced by, say, current socioeconomic climates, by, you know, global politics, by history, by all the big changes that happen in the world around them. What do you think?
I think that we are writing for the present. I've yet to read a science fiction novel that was actually about the future. It's maybe I have in there. Maybe there was one, you know. But basically, we're writing about the present. And I don't think that's bad. I think that is what it is. So I think that we can go back and look at novels 30s and see that there's maybe a focus to their concerns that's different than ours. And books can be timeless because characters, humanity is timeless. The way we interact, the way the things we worry about, how we express conflict, how we express altruism, the emotional troubles that we get into, those things happen to people across time, and they always have and they always will as long as there's people. But when I write a book, I'm inevitably influenced by what is going on around me. And I could probably pick apart all of my books and say, oh yeah, this is, you know, referencing, I don't know, whatever. But like, so Court of Fives was clearly to me, and this is something that I didn't really realize until with the second book that I'm working on, how much the current discussion in the United States about racism, which of course is a deep and fundamental problem and division in the United States, and how much that was influencing. I hadn't wanted it to be a book that the book that would seem like a message fiction, because that's not what I'm trying to write. But I could see how it was influencing, because of course she's from because she's darker. The main character, Jessamie, is darker. She's from a mixed race partnership, or you know, her parents, her father is lighter and her mother is darker. And I didn't mean that to be an allegory for race relations in the United States, but I can't help but be influenced by the fact that I have lived for over 50 years and grown up in the United States, where this is a persistent problem, and not a problem is the wrong word, it trivializes it, where this is a persistent issue. You know, I grew up watching the civil rights movement, so I can't help but be influenced by that, even though that's not directly what I'm writing about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what I was saying, is I don't think anyone, and I think if people are not aware of what's going on, and are not sensitive to the changes in the world around them, or the lack of changes in the world around them in some cases, then I don't think they'd manage to write good fiction. I think that would be a strange kind of a fiction that's completely cut off, or, you know, is that even possible? Like, I don't even know if someone can write something that doesn't have an element of, you know, thought of what's happening around them.
Well, I mean, feeling that you can ignore that what is going on around you is a political stance as well.
I suppose, yes.
You know, that's very true. Or and being unaware is, even though you may not identify that as a quote-unquote political stance, because people identify these words, people define these words so differently, but that is a political stance. You know, there's things I can ignore in my life because of who I am.
Yeah.
That other people can't ignore because it's in their face or impacting their safety every moment. You know, so the ability to ignore that in your fiction, and I don't think that books have to be about things. I think books can just be entertaining.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't have any problem with that. But even so, there's going to be things embedded. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that, you know, we have this conversation where writers get irritated because someone thinks that one of our characters expresses some view, and then someone will think that that's our view. And of course, writers are correct to get irritated about that. I often have characters say things that I don't disagree with, I mean, that I do disagree with, because it's part of their culture. I mean, my job as a writer, for me, I'm not saying that it should be other people's job as a writer, I'm saying that when I, as a writer, I want to write characters who live in their world and who are part of their culture and who think through the lens of their culture in the same way I do in mine. I don't need them to think like me. So they may say things, they may do things, they may react to things in ways that I wouldn't, or that I don't think are correct. But they need to be part of their culture if I'm writing another culture correctly. But at the same time, I do think that deeply embedded in every writer's fiction. You can probably guess some things, or you can probably get some sense of how they react and interact with the world. I do think that part, you know, we are, our fiction isn't inescapably part of us and an expression of us. So it's not like valueless. It's not neutral. Fiction is never neutral.
And it shouldn't be either. I don't know what the point of it would be. I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb and say I really don't know what the point of completely neutral. It makes it a little bland, doesn't it? It's neither here nor there.
But it's not possible.
It's not
possible to be completely neutral, because then you would be going back to this idea of who's defining what's neutral.
Yeah.
And as soon as you're defining, now you're not neutral anymore. And the other thing about me for fiction is people sometimes ask that question, what's your favorite book this year? Or, you know, what's your favorite fantasy novel? And I don't have a favorite. What blows me away is how many fantastic books there are. Because every time I pick up a book that I enjoy, it's written by someone who wrote something that I couldn't have written. So it's like that other question, you know, which book do you wish you had written? I don't wish I had written anybody else's book. I want them to write it. If I'd written it, it wouldn't be that book.
Yeah.
It would be my book, and then it wouldn't be the same. I want to read what other people have written, because their view, their experience, their aesthetic is different from mine. That's what I want when I pick up a book. I could write my books. I do. So I want something else. And that goes back again to this idea that fiction isn't neutral. It's got to be unique to each individual, or else what's the point?
Absolutely. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about world building, but since you brought up Court of Fives, we'll come back to the world building. I really enjoyed Court of Fives. I may have mentioned this earlier. But tell me about where it came from, where this particular story grew out of. You've mentioned a little bit about the race relations, but that wasn't the initial premise. That was something that I believe, I assume from what you've just said, that came in a little later on.
Okay, I can tell you. So this came out of a couple of things. First of all, the initial genesis was that my husband was doing this work and is still doing this work, actually, in Egypt.
Right.
And I started getting interested. I have to tell you, the Ptolemies, this 200, I can't remember, I'm bad at dates. The reign of the Ptolemies. So, of course, you know, Alexander the Great died, and then his generals split up his empire. And Ptolemy set up in Egypt, created a dynasty that lasted until from, so what, 323 until Cleopatra's death, whenever that was, about almost 300 years later, I guess. And the Ptolemies are like amazing, because they were just kind of, many of them were just absolutely horrible people, horrible, horrible people who would stoop to nothing to keep their power, who would kill their own children and their own, you know, wives and husbands and anybody else, really. Anyway, they were awful people, which of course is completely fascinating to me, because it's at a distance. I don't, you know, it's so far away that I can look at it kind of with, you know, you can look at it with, if it was happening next door to me, it wouldn't be cute and it wouldn't be funny and it wouldn't be interesting and it wouldn't be thrilling, right? And which is just an aside, my problem with this idea that gross human and cruel things are entertaining, because they're actually really not.
Yeah.
If they're happening, it's only when we can put them off to if we can, you know, extend our hand and see it from far away where it's not really affecting us, that we can find that entertaining. And I'm as guilty of that as a writer as anyone else. So I got interested in the Greco-Roman Egypt thing. And then I got interested in, as I said, that issue with these people coming from outside and establishing themselves, ruling over the original indigenous culture. And then, because I live in Hawaii, which for those who don't know, Hawaii was originally populated in, I'm bad at dates, so these are going to be a little off, but maybe about 1,000 years ago by voyagers who came, were not blown by the winds. They knew what they were doing. These were incredibly brilliant navigators who was populated about 1,000 years ago and originally was set up in a series of chiefdoms on each of the islands. And then eventually, about 1800, King Kamehameha conquered all the islands and established himself as the overall chief. This was about the same time that the first Europeans showed up. Actually, he comes a little after the first Europeans. And then missionaries came and business interests came, and Hawaii sits in an incredibly powerful strategic place in the Pacific Ocean, halfway across the Pacific Ocean. So whalers would put in here on the island of Maui to restock. And then, of course, as geopolitics became more important, it became an important military place to control. And there, of course, were also the economics of the land. But Hawaii was annexed by the U.S. in 1893, and basically the queen, Liliuokalani, was overthrown by American business interests. And since then, and then with the advent of the missionaries, and the increasing American influence that came in, one of the things that happened was the slow erosion of Hawaiian culture. And I want to make an aside. I could talk about Hawaii. I'm not that knowledgeable, but I could talk about it forever because it's so interesting. Hawaii was a culture that the moment they were an oral culture. You know, they use hula and mele in these oral ways to express their history. We know that as hula, but real hula is not like the kind of commercial hula that you would see. It was like oral genealogies and to express the chief's lineage and to express the history. And when the missionaries brought writing and set the Hawaiian language to writing, the Hawaiians took off with it because they are an incredibly literate, word-oriented culture. They took off with it. They began publishing newspapers in Hawaii, copious numbers of newspapers in Hawaiian. They had, in the 1890s, I believe that they had the highest literacy rate in the world. So something people don't think about. And yet, by 1960, the culture was almost gone. The only people who spoke Hawaiian were, you know, some of the elderly people living, you know, in the country or on the little island of Molokai. And, you know, people had stopped doing, there was still some hula going on, but it was, you know, a lot of it was what they call hapa hauli. They had brought in these, you know, it was kind of changed in order to, because the tourists, for tourism, you know, so it was something that didn't make the tourists uncomfortable. And in the late 60s, with the advent of the counterculture movement in the United States, young people of Native Hawaiian ancestry began asking each other, what's going on? Who are we? Who are we really? And they went out and sought out the old kupuna, the old people in the country, on Molokai, and said, you know, we want to learn about who we are and where we came from. And the old people said to them, they were stunned. They said, we thought this was going to die out with us. We thought the culture was going to die. And what happened in the intervening 40 years is the revival of the Hawaiian language, the revival of the ocean navigation. So like the Hokulea, which is a double-hulled canoe, is sailing around the world right now. It's actually leaving for the Indian Ocean. It's leaving maybe in Bali right now, but it's headed for the Indian Ocean. The revival of hula, the revival of so many things. And for me, as someone living here, as someone who came from outside and is living here, that aspect of my experience and the Greco-Roman thing kind of began to fuse together. And I thought, what would it be like if these outsiders came in and established their rule and then turned the old, they wanted to get rid of the old religion and the old culture. And so they turned it into, you know, they commodified it. Because we do that. We commodify things all the time in our culture. And so those two elements are the genesis, and the game comes out of that. The game of the fives comes out of that. It's not fully explained in the first book because I'm pacing it out over three books. But and then the third element was I wanted just to be a serious athlete because I came of age in a time when it was still weird for girls to be athletes. And if I grew up now, I would totally be an athlete.
Right.
I mean, I do consider myself one, but I grew up in a time when it was very hard for girls to compete in sports, either because the opportunities weren't there or because it was considered so strange. You know, it was something boys did, not girls. Wasn't appropriate for girls, even though, you know, why not? If you feel that way, you are that way. So those are my three influences. And sorry, I could go on like this for hours, but I'll stop now.
No, I have another. I do have another Court of Fives question, though. Magic in the Court of Fives is just, it's there. You know, there's no detailed explanation for where it's come from. It's not really even the main focus. Jess's strength, the protagonist's great strength, doesn't lie in magic. It lies, of course, in her, you know, mind and her ability to make certain decisions and do certain things. And, of course, in her body, because, as you just said, she is an athlete. Does in some way define who she is. It's who she identifies with as well. Being an athlete and sort of, you know, I love that about her, that physicality, that, you know, ownership of her body and knowing that she was able to push herself in certain ways physically as well. But magic still exists in this world. It exists in her world. I like that it didn't take center stage, but yet it remained part of the world's fabric, as it were. It could have been, I think, and I did think sometimes while reading it, it could have perhaps been the easier choice to just, you know, take magic as the focus of a story because that's what fantasy novels are meant to do. But personally, I think it would have meant less subtle world building, don't you think?
That's a really interesting comment that I agree with. I know why the magic is there and I know how it will unfold, but it isn't my focus.
Yeah.
I will say one thing about magic and fantasy novels. As much as I, like I think many people, love this idea of the person who discovers they have this special magical talent and they are, you know, turns out that they, whoops, are really the most powerful mage in the universe.
Right.
With this book, I wasn't interested in doing that story because I wanted to write a story about what people do, Jess especially. She's good because she has worked so hard on it. She's disciplined. She's focused. It has nothing to do with some magical, with some, you know, random inherited essential thing in her that she just has to uncover.
Right.
She is where she is because of how hard she's worked and how hard she's trained. And I wanted to write about that journey as opposed to the, oh, look, I'm this, you know, turns out that, you know, I have this special power I didn't know about. I wanted to write about hard work.
Now, did you really write 22 or 23 books in 26 years? We were talking about this just off the record and you said, yes, and I did this while raising kids. That's nothing short of incredible. Even without the kids, it would have been incredible. I keep wondering, I mean, It's hard for me to imagine all these worlds you've created. Did they all live in your head at the same time? Did you have to kind of swat one away while writing about the other? How does one be so prolific? Speaking of hard work, of course, that's what it is, isn't it?
It is hard work. So maybe in one way, writing a story about how hard you have to work to get good at something is maybe just talking about myself. I don't
yeah.
know. But, you know, it's funny because I never think of myself as being prolific because I see so many other people around me who are writing more. But maybe I need to look at the larger aspect of it. I guess I partly, like, I'm always so in the moment. This is what I'm doing right now. I need to get these revisions done right now. I didn't have a book come out in 2014. That always makes me feel like I fell behind, you know. Even though I have. So when people say, oh, wow, you have three books coming out. You know, I had the short fiction collection, Court of Fives, and then Black Wolves in November coming out in 2015. And then I always say, yeah, but that's because I didn't have a book come out in 2014. I started publishing in the time when the hoped for output was by a publisher was that their writer would produce a book a year. So I always thought that a book a year was a reasonable pace. So by that pace, I haven't actually kept up until you start counting how many words my books are. And then actually I realize I am more prolific. So like Traitor's Gate, which is the third of the Crossroads trilogy, is 300,000 words. I don't say that with like to brag. I just say that as a statement. So essentially that's like writing a trilogy, right? Because if your average book is about 100,000 words. So essentially that's a trilogy that came out in one volume. So mm-hmm. I guess maybe that was prolific because it was as if I had written three books that year. I don't know. I'm very driven person. I like working. I like getting better. My goal is always to get better, to figure out what I'm still not doing as well as I could be doing. If I can't be improving, and it always seems like I could be improving, you know, then I don't know what I would do. So I'm just very driven. I just want to keep working. I'm always like, oh my God, I'm getting older now. I have fewer years ahead of me than, you know, behind me. I'm at that age now. And it's like, oh, I got all these books I got to write though. So I almost feel like almost desperate, you know, that I got to get them all out there. I don't know why.
Well, that's impressive too, that you have all these, that you have all these books in you. How you've created all these worlds, these words, these characters, plots, the whole deal. How do they not bleed into each other? How do you keep them all unique? You know, while you're writing, say, in one world, do you only write in that world? I mean, that can't be possible. I'm sure you, were you simultaneously ever writing Court of Fives and, say, Black Wolves together?
I try to avoid, like, I know someone who would work on, you know, one novel in the morning and then, you know, short fiction or a different novel in the afternoon. I've discovered I can't really do that. So I can work on Court of Fives and then work on, you know, and get done like say a first draft or get done a revision and then turn that in. And then I can work on Black Wolves. But it has to be separate. I can't. But in terms of bleed through, the truth is that bleed through happens in my work all the time, because part of what happens when you've written as many books as me is I begin writing about and commenting on earlier things I wrote.
Right.
And it's not like direct, but it's like, oh, you know, I might think, you know, I didn't really like how I handled that one situation in this. And so then a situation that may be kind of similar, or a character may, I have a certain kind of character in my book. I call him the Conqueror. And he keeps showing up in my books, but I keep doing a different view of him. And so far it's only been him, but that will also change. Because I keep rethinking, why is it always a him? What if it was a her? You know, why, what bias is stopping me from making it a her? And then, you know, why do I see him as good here? And now I'm a little concerned that this conquering thing means, you know, I'm uncomfortable with seeing conquest as a positive thing for everybody. So now let's see it as a negative thing. And you see what I mean? So I'm always coming back to things in my own work and reconfiguring them. So I think in that sense, now in terms of bleed through, direct bleed through, one thing I did, and this is not apparent, isn't directly apparent, and I haven't actually talked about it until this moment, but the Court of Fives setting and Black Wolves setting are actually set on the same world in very different places. And I did that because I knew that it would be very hard for me to juggle two worlds in my head at the same time. So they're two totally different. So it would be like if I was writing a novel set in post-classic Mesoamerica and another one set in Kazakhstan, but we're in the same world, so we're dealing with two different cultures.
Right. I was just going to ask, do they share any cultures or do they share like a historical timeline?
Well, they share some things, but you have to read between. Yeah, they do share some things, but I don't flag them. You have to be reading carefully to see them. And although this is going to be trickier, there's elements of the magic which are shared. And I, again, not directly shared, but like a base level. How magic exists in the world at base level is shared by both. But there isn't like one system. I'm not someone who creates a magic system anyway. But it's there for people who want to go looking for it.
Will you tell me a little bit more about Black Wolves? What's it about?
This is a hard book. This is a book about this is a book about memory and grief. This is the book that got tangled up in my father's final illness and death. And once, because of that, it totally changed whatever the book had been meant to be. It's a really hard book for me to describe, besides the fact that it is about memory and grief. One of my beta readers said that it's like Jane Austen meets Dragon Age, which is, well, actually, she said it's like Jane Austen's Persuasion meets Dragon Age, which is kind of true. It's also got family saga aspects. I find this book the hardest of any of my books to describe, to be quite honest.
Are you happy with it?
Yeah, I am. Actually, I love it. It was such a struggle to write. It was such a struggle to write. And my editor, Davy Pillay, was so amazingly helpful with it. I always think that the last book I wrote is the best book I've ever written. And that's the last book I wrote, that I wrote and finished. And I think it does things that I couldn't have done as a writer 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I use a bit of an experimental structure that to try to get across that sense of how memory and grief weave themselves into our lives. And I love the world building, and I love the characters, and I love how I unfolded their journeys, and I love how much work I had to do to stop myself from backing into I kept having to stop myself from backing into predictable ways of dealing with people, because I would start doing that and then I would stop myself and I would say, this is predictable. This female character is being passive here, even though her situation is, even though she's in a situation where she has no active agency, she can have other forms of agency. You know, maybe she's physically trapped here, but she can have other forms of agency. She can be active in other ways, mentally, emotionally. And I had to keep stopping myself. So this was the book that I really, really wanted to explore some of the deepest biases I have myself that keep hanging me up, that keep sending me down those roads where the defaults are. And I wanted to keep pulling them back around and saying, I'm going to do this in a different way. I'm going to stop myself from writing the cliche and writing this, not even the cliche, but from writing, from going where my mind takes me first. And I want to go to that fourth place or that fifth place. So this is that book.
And is it safe to say that emotionally, at least, it's your sort of most personal book?
It is a very personal book in that sense. I don't know. I mean, I think all of my books are pretty emotional, because there's always, I actually invest a lot of emotion in my work, just different aspects of it. Because this got wrapped up with my father, I was very, very close to my father, and I miss him every day. So in that sense, yes, you could probably do a whole essay on father-daughter relationships in this book. Just because they just kept being so important. So, but is it my most personal? In some ways, yes, but in other ways, all my books are my most, each of my books is my most personal, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Jonah asks via Twitter, will you ever take us back into space?
I hope so, because for two reasons. One, I want to finish the Juron series because I know what happens and I want to write it. And I haven't yet, because I have other contracts that I have to fulfill first. And then the other reason is I do want to write a space opera, which I already have partly, mostly plotted in my head.
Okay, Kate, now here's the thing. We've been dancing around for an hour. How do you feel about Nashville?
How soon will it be back?
I don't know, Kate. I'm broken. I'm broken that it's away.
You know, I'm going to rewatch it. Is it almost September? I'm going to rewatch the whole thing, because the first two seasons are so fantastic. Yeah. Juliet's journey from who she is at the beginning is one of the great, it's just a fantastic piece of writing and acting. One of the things that I love about it most is this is a show about two women who are artists, and it's about their artistic journey. Yes, all the There's all the other stuff, all the soap opera, all the relationships, but it is about their relationship with their art. And yeah. I love that so much. It's so rare. It's so rare. And that is why that show will have my heart forever.
To me, it's starting to feel like this is like country epic fantasy. You know what I mean? I mean, it's vast, it's large. I mean, it's kind of sprawling because we've got all these new people coming in and out. And it somehow works. It somehow really works.
Well, they link. They always link. It's actually well done in terms of however they storyboard, because they always link new people into the story of one that we are already familiar with.
Yeah.
There's actually a lot to learn about looking at how fiction writing is changing today in response to the way shows like this are written and in response to the way narrative works in gaming. And I'm seeing changes now with books, and I can almost guess people who game, because there's a different, they use scenes differently than someone who like came up, you know, 30 years ago, where there's an older way that scenes are used. And shows like this are actually a great thing to study, to see how to juggle a lot of characters.
Yeah.
It's true that people say that stuff like this is trash, but yeah. You got to wonder in 1,000 years, what are people going to want to read? They're going to want to read stuff that gives them a sense of what it was like to live in the world today. So I have this theory that some of these books that are, some of these like super literary works, whatever that means, may not translate well in 1,000 years.
Absolutely.
They may be watching Nashville and saying, What a brilliant saga this is.
All right, well, we can keep talking about Nashville, but we won't bore everybody else. We'll just get everyone to go in and watch it. You need
everyone
to see
must
this for
watch
yourself.
Nashville.
Yes. All right, well, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak to me today. And I'm looking forward to Black Wolves more than I was before.
Well, thank you. I'm excited for people to read it. I'm still trying to come up with my elevator pitch, because people like that these days. But actually, I'm thrilled with it. I'm thrilled with it as a book. And I'm so thrilled with it that I'm very nervous about it coming out.
Well, let's talk about it again in November.
Oh, I would love that.